I'm very happy to welcome now to the Radio Cafe Elliot Fisher. He is Multimedia Director of Arcos Dance, and Erica Gianfrido, who is Associate Artistic Director of Arcos, and they, along with the whole of Arcos Dance, are presenting The Warriors, a love story. It opens this weekend and runs for 2 weekends at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, this is a really interesting performance. It's not only dance, it's kind of multimedia and includes theater and video and film and music and all kinds of things that is based on a very interesting legacy that you, Elliot, have been dealing with for quite a while.
Right. Yeah. I never knew my grandfather. He died before I was born in 1977, but I grew up hearing about him. He was a philosophy professor at Colorado College. And had written a number of notable books, and his best known was called The Warriors, Reflections on Men in Battle. And it was based on a journal that he wrote while he was in the war, after he had received his doctorate in philosophy.
And this is both, I mean, this book is both a kind of memoir and a work of academic inquiry and philosophy.
Right, right. He was friends with Hannah Arendt, and sort of a philosophical comrade of hers. They had a number of similar ideas about how technology and the other trappings of the 20th century were affecting humanity and our relationship with each other and with the world. He used his personal experiences and kind of confessed to what soldiers do in a way that many don't like to do.
Right.
And use these sort of concrete real-world examples to illustrate larger points about the direction that we are moving still.
Meanwhile, your grandmother, the woman he married, was a German artist who lived through the bombings in Dresden
right,
in 1945.
Right. Yeah, and he dedicated the book to her. And he says, and we use this dedication in the show, to Ursula, my wife, formerly one of the enemy, in quotes, you know, and he examines the idea of how the image of the enemy is constructed. They married after she escaped the bombing of Dresden. She ended up in Munich, and he returned after the war to help with educational reconstruction. He was helping rebuild the university system in Munich and denazify it. And she was a secretary there, and so they met. And eventually laws got lax enough for Americans and Germans to actually speak to each other. And they realized that they, you know, were interested in each other and eventually got married. And he took her back to the States.
So this is something that you have carried with you. What was it like? I mean, you didn't know your grandfather, but you did know your grandmother quite well.
Yeah, well, it was. I didn't think about it, obviously, when I was a lot younger. But she was German and, you know, had an accent, had experienced things that I wasn't familiar with until about high school when I did an oral history project and interviewed her about Dresden. My mom suggested it would be an interesting project to do about the World War II era that I had in my own family. So really when I was growing up, the thing that I knew about her most was that she was this woman who danced. That was the primary identity that she had before the war and after the war. Before the war in Dresden, she danced with a number of these modern dance innovators in Germany, Mary Wigman and Gret Paluca. And then the war was this sort of interrupting horror. And afterwards, when she came to the States with my grandfather, she started teaching dance classes. And she did it, you know, I was alive when she was still teaching. I was born, you know, in 83, and she was still teaching well into her mid-70s.
And so this legacy of war and dance and bombing and philosophical questioning about war and technology and all of that is something that you have decided to work with as an art piece. What was it? I mean, what has it been like to kind of work this stuff out through art?
Well, I've been wanting to tell this story in some way for a long time, and then in the past year with Arcos Dance, we've been experimenting more and more with the idea of multimedia performance, not just dance performance or a theatrical performance or video, but really integrating all of these different forms in a way that creates a compelling experience for the audience. And with this story, it seemed like the perfect theme to attempt another multimedia production in that way. Because, like you said, it's dealing with philosophy and words and text, and it's dealing with dance, and all of the imagery and archival footage from that really started to boom in World War II. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons we have still so present with us today, is that that was the time when all of a sudden there was sound film, you know, and this just wave, the swath of media was created, which is one of the things my grandfather was talking about in his book.
Right, right. So you, Eric, are a dancer in this performance, and you also have been participating very much in it.
Mm-hmm.
How have you kind of internalized this whole other era in history to bring it into the work?
Well, obviously, Eliot's grandmother, Ursa, was of the biggest interest to me in the whole story and her legacy with modern dance. And
do you play her, so to speak?
I don't, actually. There's another dancer portraying her in a very abstract way at the beginning of the show. But her story and my meeting with her in 2009, we went up and visited her for a few days in Colorado, and meeting this woman who shared the studio with these modern dance greats that I learned about in college and wrote papers on, and she had stories about them. Later in life, when she was teaching at Colorado College, she also danced with Hanya Holm, who was another, you know, modern dance figure in my history. So she was of the most interest to me, so I kind of delved into that from the very beginning, and how can we bring that aspect of her young dance life to the stage in some sort of interpretation. And we do kind of a modern dance homage piece where we try to recreate the feeling of modern dance and blend it with contemporary movement and bring it into the present day.
The feeling of modern dance, although, I mean, it's called modern dance, but it feels kind of dated at this point.
It does. It was modern at the time, and there's a lot of, not controversy, but a lot of conversation over what modern dance is today in 2013. And the word contemporary is thrown around, but it's really going through another evolution. So taking a look back at modern dance in its early stages has been a very interesting process.
Yeah, I mean, what does it feel like now? I remember when I first moved to Santa Fe, probably about 20 years ago, the Martha Graham Dance Company came and performed here in Santa Fe, and I couldn't wait. I mean, Martha Graham was already gone by then, but her company lived on, and they did some of the pieces for which she was the most famous. And I went to it, and I was excited, and I watched it, and it was like watching archaeology. It was just so incredibly dated, and I was not enjoying myself. And I thought, okay, hang on. It is 1946. I just put myself in that mind space. I am watching this for the first time. Yeah. We are dealing with the nuclear bomb and all of that. And then suddenly it got really good, but you had to shift your head.
Exactly. Well, the interesting thing about Ursa is that you know, when we think of modern dance, and especially German expressionist modern dance, it's very angsty and very much dealing with the political flavor of the time. And Ursula's tendency was not towards that at all. She really loved the beautiful side of it. That's why she was more attracted to Gret Palucka, who was dancing for the love of beauty and the love of movement. And that's really what we tried to pull through in this show, is that and the show itself is very dark and very intense at times. But for this one scene, we're trying to really capture that part of the joy of movement is just beauty and just expression through the body.
We're talking to Erica Gianfrido and Eliot Fisher about The Warriors, a love story. Now, in this multimedia performance, you have not only dance and theater, but also like home movies, archival footage, still photographs.
Yeah, there's a wide range of visual images that are projected onto our set. The set was designed by Chad Everett in town here, and it's all white. To enable the projections to really pop when they happen. Very minimalist, kind of Bauhaus-inspired. And the images that we project on there, yeah, there's a wide variety. I incorporate some digitized home movies from my childhood. There's propaganda cartoons that were made by both the Germans and the Americans. We've got still images that digital composites that were made by my father, Rick Fisher, who taught for many years at the College of Santa Fe. There's a scene that's inspired by a little moment in Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five that shows a scene of a bombing, a film about bombing running backwards. As much as possible, we try to see how the live performers can interact with these projected images and videos. It's really all about integration, you know, as opposed to sort of we're watching dance and now we're watching a video and now we're watching a theatrical scene. They all sort of overlap and are running constantly just at different levels throughout the show.
Very interesting. And then when all is said and done, you come back to the present and back to the question, what does this horrible war and this horrible period in history mean to us, especially in the context of all the wars and genocides that have happened since then?
Right. Yeah. It's sad that my grandfather's book is probably more relevant today than when he published it in 1959. He kind of foresees the technological evolution and the continued alienation that we are experiencing in warfare today. You know, we're so much more disconnected. He talks about a little bit about the distancing that a bomber pilot might feel from the actual impact of what they're doing on the ground and the human lives that they're affecting today. And we actually incorporate a little bit of news footage from a couple years ago about drones. You know, the drones are flown remote controlled. They're done here in the United States, and the people go home in the evening after a day's work. You know.
Right. A day's work of moving little knobs around that probably look something like a video game.
Right.
Killing any number of people.
Yeah, so one of the challenges that we've had trying to put this show together is how to communicate the vehemently peaceful messages and lives and actions of my grandfather and grandmother in a piece about war. I mean, you know, he acknowledges in the book how the two are intimately connected, you know, that they can't exist without each other, war and peace, and, you know, that there is something compelling about war, extremely compelling to many, many people. So we've been trying to get at the question of how do we get to a point where it's less compelling. You know, that's what he was trying to approach. And he and my grandmother, and the way that they lived their lives and the way that they raised the values with which they raised their daughters, was an example of that.
The piece is called The Warriors, A Love Story, and the performances are this weekend and next weekend at the CCA, Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 in the afternoon. You can find out more at arcosdance.com. The number for tickets is 473-7434. You can also look on the website of ccasantafe.org, 982-1338. Elliot Fisher is Multimedia Director, and Erica Gianfrido is Associate Director of Arcos Dance. And we want to thank you so much for being here. We will see you this weekend and next weekend. I want to say that this Munoz Waxman Gallery, which is the side building to on the outside of the regular CCA building where the Cinematheque is a fantastic space, and there's a wonderful exhibition going on in the front of
yes.
of that same space where you guys are dancing in the back.
Yeah, definitely. A few hundred watercolors
by Michelle Blade. Whom we had on the air. She did a painting every single day of the year last year. Those mm-hmm. are all on display.
She did. They're beautiful. They're very, very dark and take a very interesting look at the whole year of 2012, and it's a really nice compliment. We got to spend some time with her when she was here.
Excellent.
Yeah, it'll be fun for the audience to be able to see that exhibit on the way in. Yeah.
Right. Okay, good. Well, thanks again for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
And we're going to go out with a little bit of actual footage of Elliot's grandparents talking to one another in an interview.
Curiously enough, in my journals, I often felt that I would marry a German girl.
Glenn had been in the war, but he came as a military government officer. I never knew him as a soldier.
An education.
And he opened the University of Munich.
She
I was in charge of the German personnel. We were strictly forbidden not to fraternize.
It happens in every war that many marriages between former enemies take place.
Americans and Germans were not supposed to talk to each other.
My wife feels, however, that she never was an enemy of mine.
He found destructive business of war was too much. He wanted to come and do something constructive.
And I dedicate my book to her. It runs to Ursula, formerly one of the enemy.
So we didn't talk, but I found one orange on my desk.
It never occurred to me that one shouldn't do this, that this was inappropriate.
And this was the first sign of attraction or getting together.
And I fell in love with her and married her.
My friends, when they heard I married an American, were very angry. They said, how can you? You are a traitor. How could you? The Americans bombed Dresden, and here you marry an American. And I lost many friends.
And I think of the old Greek myth of the marriage of love and war. One of their children was named Harmonia.
Glenn was a human being, and so fine and so sensitive, and so made no difference what nationality.
I fell in love with her and married her.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Chris Moore. He is professor at the Cerfe Institute, and he will be presenting the film Primer as part of the CCA and Cerfe Institute Science on Screen film series tomorrow night, Wednesday, February 6th at 7 o'clock at the CCA. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. So Primer is the ultimate, I think, low-budget film. It was made for $7,000. It won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize in 2004 to the amazement of everybody, including the filmmaker who did virtually everything on this film, Shane Carruth. He's amazing. He wrote and directed and produced and edited it and did the music and all of that. When did you first see the film, and how did it strike you the very first time you saw it?
I saw it, I think, at CCA, and of course we're really lucky to have CCA here in town that we get to see these films that are not part of the top 40. You know, it's a tricky movie, but it's become, a cult classic in addition to getting these awards, because although it is challenging, it is also in the end very tightly constructed, and ultimately everything makes sense. The the frustration with science fiction movies often is that, you know, at first there's a cool concept, but at some point, you know, you somewhere along the writing by committee and producing by committee, the film sort of goes off the rails. This one stays on the rails. It follows this very elegant idea to its logical conclusion.
And the very elegant idea has to do with time travel, and it's, I think, pretty much impossible, well, maybe for you, but for most people, I think it's pretty hard to get the movie on the first viewing. It's about these guys who, in their garage, kind of engineer guys, make this machine that enables them to travel through time.
Don't give too much away.
Well, I mean, that's in every
Absolutely.
Blurb about it, and we won't give too much away about it. But
one cool thing about it is that as they're discovering this technology, they're not quite sure at first what it does. They happen upon it almost by accident. You know, it seems from hints in their conversation that they're trying to do something with superconductors and trying to do something with magnetism, and maybe it has something to do with gravity, and all of a sudden it has something to do with time. And the way that they discover that is done very convincingly. And the filmmaker Shane Carruth talks about how he was inspired by how fundamental technologies like the transistor were discovered almost by accident, almost at the same level, you know, with people working essentially in their garages. And so, you know, these guys are in a startup company, and the dialogue is very, very realistic. And then suddenly they have this technology. So what should they do with it, and what happens next? And, you know, time travel is almost a genre, right?
I love the genre.
Yeah, you've got Back to the Future, which is, by the way, also regarded by aficionados as one of the better time travel movies. But here, you know, what happens once you have this technology, and how does the story unfold? And it takes the characters to very unexpected places. And so it is quite a it is quite a fascinating film. And you're right, it's not necessarily easy to catch every detail the first time through.
Or the second. I've watched it twice so far.
Well, but, you know, so we'll be there to have a discussion. Maybe we can untangle it with the Q&A afterwards. But like I said, it's a very well-made film, considering, as you said, the $7,000 budget. It's very well acted, very well constructed. It's sort of a, I would say, a tightly wound machine.
Now, here's a probably stupid question, but is time travel theoretically possible in any realm of physics that you know or are involved in?
You know, there's a... Of course, it's like traveling faster than light, which is, in a sense, it's the same thing as time travel, because relativity says that if you can travel faster than light, you can also travel backwards in time. It's one of the great dreams. You know, certainly a lot of the science fiction stories and a lot of the futures we'd like to imagine rely on this. We don't know if the laws of physics allow it. We know, we think, that at the very smallest scales of space and time, below the Planck scale, where the Big Bang happened, where quantum effects become tangled up with gravity, we think that causality, our notion of past and future, somehow gets fuzzy down there, but we don't know how, because we still have not found that grand unified theory that combines general relativity with quantum mechanics. You know, some people say that there's this space-time foam, sort of lots of tiny wormholes popping in and out of existence, so perhaps we could grab one and make it bigger. Who knows? It would be, we don't know if it's possible to hold a wormhole open. A wormhole is like something with a black hole at one end and a white hole on the other. Our current theories predict that this would sort of instantly close, but if you had some very exotic kind of matter, maybe you could hold it open. You know, there's some thought that if you have very rapidly spinning, very dense objects, that this could kind of, that these could drag space-time around them, creating a loop in time that you could enter and leave at will. But then again, it might be inside a black hole, so maybe you could do time travel, but you'd never get out again. So there, you know, it's wonderful to speculate about. But what I like about this film is that it introduces time travel in a kind of, you know, garage band way.
Yeah, right.
And having it be this unexpected consequence of what these guys are trying to do.
The film, we're talking about the film Primer with Chris Moore, is written, I mean, the dialogue is utterly opaque to non-scientists. You don't know what they're talking about. And so I wanted to ask you whether it's accurate.
Well, it's a bit opaque to me too, but there are some nice hints thrown out. So you hear them talking about superconductors. You hear them trying to create this magnetic field in this box, and you hear them talking about Feynman diagrams. And so, yeah, from as a scientist, I can tell you that the fictional science in this movie is pretty good.
Yeah.
And, for instance, Feynman diagrams describe how particles can collide and interact, and how, for instance, pairs of particles and antiparticles can appear out of the vacuum. And the interesting thing about a Feynman diagram is if you turn it sideways or even upside down, it's still true. It's still correct. So you hear the inventors talking about Feynman diagrams and recognizing that at a fundamental level, physics is perfectly happy to run forwards or backwards. From the point of view of elementary particles, the direction of time doesn't really matter. And so... this is part of how we imagine time travel might happen. I mean, for us living at the, you know, the scales of length and time and energy that we're used to, this seems to be this inexorable arrow of time, right? We can remember the past, but not the future. We can't return to the past. But from the point of view of elementary particles, that arrow of time isn't there at all. And in fact, it's a big mystery, and people argue about it a lot, both physicists and philosophers, about why is it that somewhere between the elementary particle level and the level of macroscopic reality that we're used to, this arrow of time appears? Something along the way goes from being reversible, perfectly happy to run forwards or backwards, to irreversible. Eggs don't unscramble themselves, and so on. So that is a matter of much contention in science, and it's a wonderful philosophical puzzle.
Well, that's one of the things that's really great about the movie, is it brings up all kinds of philosophical issues. And, I mean, one of them that, and again, we don't want to give away too much about the movie, but there is one of the guys who looks at a building and another version of the other guy walks through and the first one sees himself. And so if there is time travel, does everything suddenly double?
Right. And so I guess writers always have to make this interesting choice when they write time travel movies. So if you go back in time, does that rewrite history? Do you get to be there along with your past self? What happens if you meet your past self? And so this movie does a very good job of exploring a particular choice of what would happen and what the consequences of that, both logical and moral, would be.
Well, and that's the other thing, is you've got these kind of young 20-something guys who are not really equipped to deal with the moral consequences of their actions, because that's not what they were really involved in the first place. They're engineers.
That's true too. They're young tech guys. They were hoping to make a bundle out of this invention. They didn't even realize that it would do what it does, and so yeah, now they want to live their lives and benefit from it somehow, and things go off the rails a little bit.
Right. So how many times have you watched this, if I may ask? Do you have any do you know?
I think 3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
I have a friend who, when this movie came out, my housemate at the time was a projectionist at the CCA, and he became so fascinated with this movie that he watched it every single time he projected it, and by the end felt that he understood the whole thing. But that was a lot of runs of the movie.
Since we're focusing on this one showing, I don't want people to think that they won't enjoy it the first time through.
No,
but you will walk out. You will walk out of there with questions and a lot of fun conversations to have with whoever you come to the theater with.
Well, and also, you're going to do a Q&A after the film.
Yes, and I will, to the extent that I understand it, I'll be happy to talk about it. But, I think that, so that, again, the plot is very interesting and very tight. As you say, the characters and the dialogue are very good as well. And Shane is coming out with a new movie sometime this year called Upstream Color.
Yes.
Which, from the trailers, also looks very compelling and very, very mysterious.
And it's another, what looks like, pretty scary thriller, maybe scarier than Primer. And I watched a little interview of him saying that it was a romantic movie.
Scary and romantic. That
Scary and romantic. Chris Moore is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and tomorrow night he will be presenting the film Primer. It's part of the Science on Screens film series, which is a collaboration between the CCA and the Santa Fe Institute, and there's more information about that at ccasantafe.org. You can call the CCA at 982-1338. And the screening is at 7 o'clock. Chris, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
And by the way, I hear rumors that Shane Carruth, the filmmaker, might also be available.
Oh, are you going to Skype him in?
That's what Jason Silverman tells me. I hope it works out. I'll have a couple questions for him myself.
Yeah.
That would be, even more interesting than having me there.
Well, I should say it would be great to have you both, and we will see. So that's yet another thing that we can look forward to. Chris, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And I'd like now to welcome David Olson. He is the artistic director of Theater Work, which is performing a play called Beauty of the Father by Nilo Cruz, which opens this Friday at the James A. Little Theater and runs for 2 weekends. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
Always good to have you back. And one of the institutions in Santa Fe, institution by now. You've been here, theater work, for what, 17
seasons? We're in our 17th season.
Yeah, amazing.
Working on production 113 in that time. That production, not talking about poetry readings and
right.
musical evenings and all of that.
Well, one of the groups that really does very high-quality theater here in Santa Fe. Now, tell us, without totally giving the play away,
sure.
but tell us a little bit about this play, Beauty of the Father.
Well, Beauty of the Father is Nilo Cruz's second play with Federico García Lorca, the Spanish poet, sort of at the center of it. We did the other one as well, Lorca in a Green Dress.
Right.
We did that in 2004, I think. And ever since then, Nilo and I have been in touch, have been communicating. He loved our... He came out to see Lorca in a Green Dress, and he loved it and was very moved by the production and so on. So that made us solid colleagues
yeah.
and friends. So when this play came across my desk, literally, my wife Paula, who's been the managing director of theater work since it was founded in Minnesota 46 years ago, does these pre-selections of plays. She sort of knows what I might be pulled towards or what we're capable of as a company. And often I'm so overstimulated by plays that I can't get down to a little stack. And she does.
Yeah.
So often when it comes time to choose the season, there's this stack of 15 plays or so on my desk, and this was right on the top. I always know what that means. let's do it.
Let's look at this one right now.
So it suits us, as we can talk about why.
Yeah.
Well, it suits us because it breaks through, you know, theatrical conventions and challenges all of us, challenges the design team and me, to find solutions for stories that are being told that are sort of outside the beginning, middle, and end in a certain place kind of a story, which I also am drawn to at times. But this type of story that is very sort of poetic, I was thinking on the way over here, it's sort of like, you know, García Márquez meets Chekhov, meets a telenovela, all stimulated and inspired by the vision of Lorca and then by Nilo Cruz.
Right.
Who is very determined to create plays that speak to experiences in the world of people who are outside of the mainstream or who are in some way marginalized. So he often goes for those ideas. So it hit me very strongly when I first read it. I could see how difficult it might be to do.
I mean, it's a... One of the things that's so interesting about it is, and I mean, we have love triangles are a staple of literature, but this is really a love rectangle.
Yes.
In which every point of the rectangle hits every other point going across and on the sides and
Absolutely.
Kind of Lorca in the middle.
Far too much love. And
yeah.
Far too much and an equal degree of alienation and loss in that rectangle as well. They aren't particularly good lovers, let's say.
Right. Really,
they come
nobody
to the,
is.
They come to it with desire that maybe can't be requited and with hurt that can't be solved by loving these people. You see what I mean, of course. As is true of many, many people. So love in the play, yes, it has the complexity that love in the world has. It doesn't simply solve things. If anything, it perhaps makes things, though, sometimes come into sharper relief, which it needs to do in a play. Things have to come to some sort of relief. I mean, some sort of vision. You have to see it somehow.
Right.
You don't just sort of, it's not like overhearing a conversation in a restaurant about love and then hearing it some other time or never again. Something happens on the stage. But, you know, Nilo Cruz has been drawn before to Lorca's personal struggle and tragedy, you know, his being murdered at the age of 38. So Nilo set this play in 1998, which would be the centennial of Lorca's birth. And Nilo has often been drawn, and I'm very drawn to it right now because I'm working on it, to Lorca's insistence that death is one thing and it's inevitable. And in certain aspects, there are certain aspects of death that aren't even to be feared because they're inevitable or they're freeing. But that what isn't inevitable is wounding or the wound in the world, because humans choose to do those things. And so Nilo has done that with this play, exploring the price, you might say, the cost of the wound, you know, the one that's held for a long time or the one that's just a lashing out that wounds. Having said that, as you had a chance to see a rehearsal, you can see, though, that he creates a very beautiful rhythm for examining that and experiencing that. It's almost musical in a certain way. You know, it sort of flows on because of Lorca. Lorca guides us through it. He speaks directly to the audience and takes us through the stories of these other four people, and that makes it flow.
Yeah, and it helps each one kind of try to make sense of what's going on. And mm-hmm. The central character, who is a father, the play is called Beauty of the Father, is a man who is reuniting with his daughter for the first time in her adult life. Mm-hmm. And that reunion alone is enough material for an entire play in itself, without all the other complexities of mm-hmm. the other characters.
Especially since he abandoned this, she was a child then, and her mother in the United States, and returned to Spain, leaving them there. So now she's come to Spain to find him.
Right.
And yes, very complicated, very, very powerful human activity, though, that idea of moving from abandonment to some sort of answer or even some sort of reconciliation if possible.
Right. And of course, many abandonments like that are complicated, because who really left whom?
Right.
And then this question, which I think is a really important and interesting exploration of what is selfishness, mm-hmm. if you're an artist. And I was thinking, here's Nilo Cruz writing about this and probably reflecting on it for himself as a playwright.
Absolutely.
And as a person who may be a father, may be a family man of some kind, and is also a lover and is an artist.
I can tell you that in the rehearsal process, of course, I have read the question of this artist, Emiliano, to Lorca, the ghost of Lorca. Have I been selfish
yeah.
as an artist? And I had read it, of course, and we'd had read-throughs, and I was hearing it. But there was a moment in a rehearsal in which the actors were off book, and I was also, therefore, not looking at the book. There was a stage manager following the script. I was just looking and listening. And it hit me very hard at that moment, that question.
Yeah.
Very hard. Have I been selfish
yeah.
with all this? It's a complex and an important question, I think.
Very much so, because we are taught to serve,
mm-hmm.
and it's right to serve.
Sure.
And if you are going to be an artist and devote your life passionately to something, and you spend all your life serving others, maybe in mm-hmm. what seem like trivial ways, you're not going to do your art.
Right. You couldn't. There is a kind of solitude involved, kind of necessary.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, you find people in your life, and in my case, I found a person to spend my life with who understands that.
And who is involved in the same enterprise.
Involved, too, now. I mean, you know, became involved and been my partner in that, too.
But yeah.
I did have some answer to that question that night, although it hit me very hard.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the many interesting questions in this play. Now, as you say, Lorca, who is played by Jonathan Dixon in the play, is at the center of the action. And for you as a theater person, having read and directed plays by Lorca, does this Lorca seem like the Lorca that you know?
It does, indeed. It does seem like the Lord guy I imagined. I think so. I think Nilo is very, very close to Lorca's vision and Lorca's poetry, because to get myself ready to direct this, I reread every Lorca poem in both languages out loud. I studied them again, and I found images in the poems that are in the play, you know, all over the place.
Right.
I mean, it's just filled with the images of the nest, of the moon, of the horse, I mean, of the tide, all those kinds of things, white roses, and so on. So all of that, you know, resonates. But it also resonates with Lorca's work in the theater. People don't always know that when he came back from a trip to the big tour, you might say, extended visit to the United States, where he spent a lot of time in Harlem, when he came back to Spain, he created a theater company, a little company that went out into very remote little villages and performed on, they'd clear a space or sweep a sidewalk and perform for free. And he did that, and while he was out there, they were not only performing, but he was also, as he said, trying to decide how his work could become the voice of the voiceless. So that struggle really resonates with me. It always has. I mean, my work, life and work in Colombia for 8 years as a young person took me to that question, you know, what is my work for? So I always remember that there are those who don't have a voice or can't find a voice, and that we have these opportunities. I mean, there we are in this beautiful theater, all this equipment, all these very talented people creating things, and we have this great gift, really, in front of us. And so I still ask myself, you know, does it add up? Is it a contribution? You know,
yeah.
Is there something being addressed, or is there an experience inherent in it that someone may need to see made real on the stage? So, this play answers that, as others have for us, Emile's Enemies, on and on. We've done play, and we've done comedies, of course, too. We've even done operettas, because that's part of the human experience as well, to sing, to laugh, to dance, of course. This one takes us to this beautiful encounter we would call it a spirit. The Spanish call it a duende. So Lorca comes back not as a ghost that frightens and wearing a white sheet or something, everybody runs screaming. He comes back as a duende, and the duende, and it's very important in Spanish culture, it's the familiar spirit, the one who comes probably to help in some way, help someone who's about to pass through something and help them pass through it. Even
whether
death.
Whether it be in a transition in your life, uh-huh, or transition
from life to death. Right. But they're not frightening spirits at all. They're sort of familiar spirits. It's a lovely concept, really. And it also seems in the play, because Lorca has been dead for 100 years when the play is supposedly happening, that he is also searching himself for some connection, reconnection, or extended connection, or repeated connection to human activity. He loved human activity.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
He was a great conversationalist, a singer, he wrote music. You know, he loved the life of people.
Well, so, and you think with somebody whose life was cut short like that, who loved life so much, their ghost probably would not be all that happy, right, out in...
would be restless.
Wherever it is. Wherever that is. And they would want nothing more than to be themselves, uh-huh, again.
In this case, that wherever, though, is in Granada, around Granada, which was Lorca's great love of a city. And so at least he's being restless around the city that he loves. So there are probably other plays to be written or other visits by Lorca to be, you know, written about. I'm sure there are many who have experienced him, his duende.
So we're talking about the play Beauty of the Father by Nilo Cruz, which is opening this weekend and runs for 2 weekends with theater work. And you have been doing, I've seen a number of the plays that you've done at the James A. Little Theater where the audience is not out in the audience. They're sitting on the stage and you kind of build these, not bleachers, but raked seats on each side so that the audience members are facing each other as well as the stage.
Right, we do. We've done it that way before. We've done it just with the audience on one side. But what we end up doing, because there's a very large, very well-equipped stage there, it's as big as many little theaters in town, you might say, the whole place. So what we end up doing is creating this seating area.
Yeah.
Just on one side, just off the lip, you might say, of the stage, into that. There's a big gap between the stage and the seats at the James Little. We've also performed there with the whole house, you know, with people in the seats, and used the stage as a proscenium. But I like this intimacy, I think, especially for a play like this.
Right.
In fact, we even chose to not create a painted floor, which we've often done there. We've often created a painted floor. We chose this time to leave the walnut floor bare and let it run right over under the feet of the audience as well, so that they're very, it's clearer that this, because Lorca's always speaking to someone and explaining things and hoping that they will keep coming along with him further. And though that someone, of course, is the audience. So we've wanted to let them feel almost as if they've just come, you know, he's actually brought them there. Or they've come upon him somewhere under a tree or near a white rose bush or by the sea. And he has taken them. Come with me to see this artist near here who's trying to paint my portrait. And we'll see what's happening with him. And so we go. So this intimacy, the intimacy of having the audience on two sides. In other words, one ends up not then creating sort of illusions you can't create pictures that are seeming to be, to sort of trick an audience into seeing something. You have to bring them into the action of the play and let them find the emotional qualities and everything right there in what's being said and done.
And as always, you have a beautiful and very poetically constructed set.
Oh, yeah.
With, I imagine, images from Lorca's poetry.
Absolutely. All over the place, even on the backs of canvases that are sort of flying into the air, you might say.
Yeah.
Fragments of Lorca's poems are handwritten on them. And we had great fun with that. That was really wonderful. And our Richard Gonzalez, who's been our props master since we moved to Santa Fe, he was right there at the beginning, has created again all these and found or created all these beautiful little objects that if you no matter where you look, and we sort of like this approach, when you look at the set. Almost anywhere you look, you're drawn back into the story or into the imagist content of the story. So there's not that we want people sitting there just staring at the set, but they come early.
Yes, indeed.
They could just watch the set for a while. Somebody said you should sell tickets to the set.
Well, the play is called Beauty of the Father. It's by Nilo Cruz. Presented by Theater Work, of which David Olson is the artistic director. And you can go this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and the next weekend as well. And then the following week, starting on Valentine's Day, February 14th, it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, all at 7:30. And then Sundays are at 2 o'clock, and it closes on Sunday, February 17th. It's at the James A. Little Theater, which is on Cerrillos Road on the campus of the New Mexico School for the Deaf. For reservations, you can call 471-1799 or go to theaterwork.org. David Olson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me today again.